Welcome, folks, to The Uncommon Good with Bo Bonner and Dr. Bud Maher. Every week, diving deep into the truth of Catholic social teaching and restoring all things in Christ. The Uncommon Good, live from Iowa Catholic Radio's Mercy Live Up Studios.
The Uncommon Good is on the air. I'm Bo Bonner.
Dr. Bud Maher.
We are coming to you live from these United States. Myself? Des Moines, Iowa, here in snowy middle of the world, Iowa, in warm Iowa Catholic Radio Mercy Live Up Studios. Here I am the Director of Mission and Ministry at Mercy College of Health Sciences, the Director of the Zeta Foundation for Ethics, for Leadership in Foundations Ethics. You can find both of those at mchs.edu and zetainstitute.com. Bud, out in Pittsburgh, what are you up to?
Well, I'm at the National Institute for Newman Studies in Pittsburgh, newmanstudies.org, and we've got a pep in our step today.
I know. So Tim O'Malley, actually, he's an all-star. He's been on the show many times. He's going to be on today because he's wrote another book. But I was going to joke with him that, like, if he makes us mad, we'll just kick him off and talk about Newman becoming a saint, right? Isn't that the open threat we should give him?
That's right. Yeah, news reached us from Rome today. And it's funny, Bo, because I was drawn to Newman because, you know, he helped me find my way into the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of funny because Newman was very English. And so, and I'm kind of like Midwestern, not English.
Right, yes.
So this morning I was like, break out the daddy light! And everyone was like, we should probably do sherry and white cake.
Can you get natty light in Pittsburgh? Isn't it Yingling?
Well,
Yingling light!
I hear people reach for Yingling, but the big one is Iron City.
Like,
if you want that street cred, there's Iron City, Iron City Light, and it's good yellow swill. I can't complain.
This is my favorite thing about this show, which maybe we're getting kicked off soon for talking about this, but we literally brought up Newman becoming a saint, and it quickly devolved into what is the natty light of Pittsburgh. So good job, the uncommon good.
Well, I was gonna make I was gonna make a joke that Newman would be like, get back to work, but that would be like German saint. He's very British, and sometimes, like when I'm in Newman circles, I feel unrefined. But they've embraced me with open arms.
Now that's right. You are more the unwashed Irish masses that Newman helped, even though you are very Swedish, but not Swedish, Norwegian. Scandinavian.
Yep.
I hope our sponsors still like us having us after that weird caveat. But if you want to if you want to type out complaints, you can email it, but then also print it out. You probably need cartridge printing ink, and you can get it from Cartridge World, 801 73rd Street, Windsor Heights. But I think I might be the first person that's saying, if you want to complain about our show, you can use our sponsor's product to help complain about our show.
Well, maybe a way to spin this back towards appropriate piety is, like, if you want to send your friends an announcement of Newman's impending canonization or, like, a holy card, you can do that using Cartridge World.
Print out many of the many wonderful prayers that he has. This leads us into, we're also underwritten by Mercy College of Health Sciences. Every time I get the chance to host either orientation or we have visits on campus, they ask me to do a prayer, and my go-to prayer every time is Newman's famous one from his meditations, that I am not made for naught, right? That I have my purpose. I won't read the whole thing. Maybe we can, like, drag that up and read that by the end of the show. But yes, Newman's idea that, like, God's providence works and has a specific idea for me in this life. Mercy College of Health Science, that's what we believe that we're a conduit of, that you have a calling to a vocation, so even more than a career, and Mercy College is a place for you to go live that calling out. So mchs.edu, Mercy College.
Bo, I'm still on the, like, emergency text line, and you guys have had a few
doozies.
Classes canceled this semester.
I know. When you were here at Mercy physically, I know, spiritually and online, you're still there. Those two things are distinct, by the way. We can have a whole show about that. Did you ever have class canceled?
And I can't remember. I feel like I brought warm tropical air to Des Moines. But ever since I've left, things have really
that's a good point.
Cooled off.
You are global warming. Yeah. What's crazy is you cannot believe how many discussions in the administration we've had to have about what is the difference between, you know, like, closing and late starts. Everybody's always like, oh, those scholastics, and their distinctions. But all you got to do is be at an administrator's program where they're asking what's the difference between closing campus and canceling class or a delayed start, and all of a sudden you just sound like you're, you know, done SCOTUS trying to make Aristotelian distinctions.
This would really throw St. Thomas off to see like the disputatios that are taking place.
Yeah, I'm always about a second away. I'm like, what's the genus of cancellations and what's the specific difference? And then I just know that they would be like, you're fired. You're canceled. So, we alluded to it already, Bud. So who do we have on the guest for our show? Like I said, an all-star for sure. We've had him a few times.
No, I'm really happy to have Tim O'Malley back. He teaches at Notre Dame. He's the director of the McGrath Institute there.
Right.
And is doing all sorts of great work. But his most recent publication, I think, is really timely. A, because it's Valentine's Day Eve, but B, because it's just a conversation that the church needs to be having and that a lot of us don't do well, myself probably included. So his book's called Off the Hook, God, Love, Dating, and Marriage in a Hookup World. And Tim does some really just fascinating theological work talking about how the church, how its formation of young people stands apart from the cultural liturgies of the world. So I'm just really looking forward to this one.
Yeah, and, he writes a book every 7 months, I believe. But
right.
he writes fantastic ones, and he puts us all to shame. So, yeah, we're really happy to have him back on. Last time we talked about born-again Christians. By the way, we need to find out if he does his own titles or if he has someone, like, helping him out, because they're always zingers. I'm always impressed, like, zing! So, Off the Hook with Dr. Timothy O'Malley, all-star for the Uncommon Good. Here when we get back after these messages. Stick around, Bo Bonner, Bud Maher. This is the Uncommon Good. Back with the Uncommon Good, Bo Bonner and Dr. Bud Maher. But he's been on the show before. Like I said, he's an all-star to the Uncommon Good. But I'll let you go ahead and introduce our guest today.
Yeah, Timothy O'Malley is a Catholic theologian, author, speaker, and managing director of the McGrath Institute for Church Life at Notre Dame. He's the author of a lot of things, but especially three books, including Born Again Catholic, Liturgy and the New Evangelization, and the book we're discussing this morning, Off the Hook. Tim, thanks so much for being back with us.
It is great to be here and to talk to both of you on this beautiful morning.
Oh, are you rubbing it in? Because, like, we're snowbound. Or do you have? Where are you at?
We have snow.
Oh, okay.
I'm in South Bend. We had about 5 inches this morning.
One of my favorite things, keeping track of you, like, you know, a creepy 21st century stalker on Twitter, is I'm always like, all right, where's Tim at, A? And B, is he currently writing or publishing a book as we speak? So you're busy, man. I'm really impressed.
Well, I got to make the money. It's about the Benjamin.
That's why you're in it, right? Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, that's good. Hey, so, Tim, I'm impressed because you're going to also be another first-time thing for the Uncommon Good. Bud, you wanted to give a warning. I'm impressed. You were talking about this. What do you want to warn the audience real quick?
Oh, Tim, I'm guessing you probably saw on social media this morning that Pope Francis has approved Newman's canonization.
Of course, we're
moving towards that. And on the intro, Bo was saying, like, if this conversation gets too boring and goes off the rails, we can just, you know, talk about Newman.
Right. That is what I expected, actually.
No.
I was prepared to speak exclusively about Newman.
Well, with that in mind, I've really enjoyed this new book, Off the Hook. And I'm sort of curious, like, were you inspired to write it because you spend so much time with young people and just found that these conversations, like, there was a lot of misunderstandings and things out there?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it came forth from a class that I taught at Notre Dame on the sacrament of marriage, and a lot of the assumptions I thought I had about the students were wrong about, you know, what hookup culture was about, that it was about some sort of sense of, like, you wanted to engage in a lot of different sort of sexual activities. But I think what inspired me and what surprised me was that actually it wasn't as much about sex as it was like a total loss of the capacity for communion and intimacy. Mm. And so how can the church's teaching on the sacrament help inform that in a different way than, you know, simply discussing questions of purity or sexual purity, which in some ways is part of the problem, but it's not the whole problem.
So, and in that regard, maybe, of course, part of the problem, but almost as a symptom rather than a cause. Do you think that that's something that, if you wanted people to read the book and say why this is a different, it's not a different take, but that, like, why do we need another book like this? Is precisely because you're getting to the root of the problem instead of exploring maybe some of the worst, most obvious symptoms.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things I discovered with the students is that actually it wasn't very hard to get them to express displeasure about the kind of sexual intimacy that was, sort of sexual faux intimacy, I should say, that was expressed. They really don't like it. But that doesn't mean that suddenly then they're capable of actually communicating with one another, committing to anything beyond 15 minutes. And that even my very religious students, who would have no way, shape, or form participate in the hookup culture, are influenced in some ways by it because there is afraid of commitment, afraid of real intimacy and communion. So the book is really trying to do something different. It's like boring theology of the body is what I call it. So it's like, what if, like, the heart of the sacrament of marriage wasn't some sort of transformative sexual encounter, but like making sure that you had the trash taken out every Monday? And how would that sort of save your whole sort of form of life?
Yeah, I feel like maybe my wife texted you and asked me you to talk about that. So,
both of your spouses have gotten in touch with me.
No, Tim. Like early on in the book, you talk about the research, and I'm probably going to mispronounce his name, but is it Mark Rigneris?
No, that's right.
Yeah, and I thought that was fascinating. Like something that maybe our readers would benefit from hearing from, where like dating in America has just been transformed, I think, in the last, you know, few decades. And would you mind sharing some of like Mark's research and what he's uncovered about the transformation of how we approach relationships, like in the early stages?
Yeah, I mean, the example I always use, it's actually from one of his other books, which is that he co-wrote Premarital Sex in America. And when I speak to boomers, you know, they'll say something, boomers, whether they're sort of religious priests, bishops, their assumption is, you know, okay, so the question is, you know, you meet someone, you fall in love, and then you make a determination of, you know, the church's role should be to try to get you to not have premarital sex, right? So you're 4 months in and you start engaging in sexual activity instead of entering into marriage. That's not really what's happening. What's functionally happening today amongst many sort of young people is that the first encounter they're having with someone is mediated sexually, and it's mediated first through some kind of digital technology. And that means they're meeting one another on like an app like Tinder, which Mark speaks about in his book. And they're looking at this app, they're swiping, I always forget which way, they're swiping the direction that means that you think they're hot. Yeah. They're meeting up with one another, they're engaging in sexual intercourse, and then only later do they start to have conversations about, like, well, what's your last name? Yeah. Where did you grow up? And there's like a deep fear of intimacy and communion. And of course, it changes the capacity for commitment, right? Because now there's a virtual world with infinite possibilities of who you could date and marry. And that means that you're much more willing to give up on every relationship because who knows what could exist on the other side.
Mm. Yeah, you know, it seems to me that every successive generation over-imagines that what the kids these days are dealing with are just a difference in degree from what they dealt with. And what I hear, not only from your book, but from the best sources, is that literally the whatever we're calling the dating scene has become different in kind. It is a new sort of phenomenon, and that's one of the biggest difficulties for even quote-unquote Generation X people, like I think everybody on this. Tim, you're always looking so young. Maybe you are a millennial. But the idea is, you know, we imagine, oh, it's just us, but a few degrees worse. And that really sort of blocks us from having any intelligent conversation about the societal impact of this, because our failure of imagining how completely different and the ramifications negatively that huge stark difference can make. Do you think that's fair to say that what this evidence is demonstrating is a different kind of field that young people are facing today.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is not, you know, like a sort of just a gradual departure of morals and mores, right? Like if we could only return to some pristine era.
94.
Yeah, 94. That's the year.
Yeah.
Then we would be fine. But no, I mean, the whole field has changed, and it has a lot to do with those smartphones, those devices in our hands that have transformed how we meet and talk to one another.
Well, and, you know, this isn't really like an original thought, but one thing that comes up in my own conversations with college students is like there does seem to be this perception among many outside the church that the church is sort of anti-body. And what I picked up on from your book is like it feels like there's almost like this pervasive Gnosticism in the culture where like in some ways we can feel all revolutionary, like we're throwing off the shackles of kind of like religion that that said like the body was bad or something. But it sounds like a lot of persons' first encounters with sex is mediated, like you said, through a smartphone. And I mean, I've been struck by hearing news stories about like Americans opting out of intimacy, especially men, where it's like the idea of an actual relationship with another person is almost like too difficult.
Yeah, I mean, what I found, my students sort of describe this, but I think all the data is pointing towards actually a decrease in the amount of sex that Americans are actually interested in engaging in, especially young adults, young people, because that they get so attached to this virtual world. And the thing about actually being in a relationship with a concrete human being is that they require things from you. You know, they need you to take out the trash. They need you to be there. They might need you in case that you have a child. And so that there's this real sense of it's better to engage in pornography. It's greater to engage in this sort of virtual experience where you don't have to have any communion at all. Right. So let's just cut out the actual other person. And I can just focus on this, you know, my own sort of basically an erotic relief, a way of escaping. You know, gosh, it's, you know, the number of relationships I've encountered teaching this course and talking to students in which men and women really just have no capacity to actually be friends with one another, to talk to one another. It's all disembodied.
Yeah. You know, half of this radio show is like if Bud and I accidentally read something before we talked to the guest. So I was reading Dante's Inferno and thinking of Canto 14, where the weird one where like the circle of the suicides and like their trees and the harpies pick at their limbs. And I know you're all like going, where on earth is this going? But I was trying to talk to students that what Dante was getting at is this sort of profound hatred of the body that lies at the root of all of these sort of sins, the sins of violence, where we always think of violence as, you know, injuring someone physically, but violence can be violating the sort of relationship that someone has sort of like through their property, through their body. You know, violence against God is blasphemy, this, that, and the other. And I start to think about, we don't like I said, violence, if we even talk about sexual violence, we're thinking about like, you know, people assaulting people. But it sounds to me that there's a lot of underlying violence in the way that we even consider relationships, because we only are going to interact with people manipulatively and not see how we're getting manipulated back. In a world where people are more and more concerned, right, about sexual assault and things, and rightly so, Tim, do you think that that's something that you see missing, if not in students, maybe just in all of your research in this sort of area, that there's an underlying violence to all of this because of that Gnosticism Bud was talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I do see what you're saying exactly, and I actually see it much more acutely. You know, I sort of remind my students that actually, I mean, it's a really happy reminder that, you know, relationships are always fraught with the possibility of violence, of one person doing whatever they can to get their way and to sort of grasp and seize power and control, right? And, you know, there's been a narrative in the church. You know, I'm not one to sort of dismiss, you know, the gift of sexuality and the gift of family life. But I like to remind my students that, you know, there actually is a kind of genius to what St. Augustine said about marriage and how it healed the human person. That basically what it did is it took something that could be very violent, right? Sex, which is of course never really just about sex. You know, sex is always about power. It's always about control. It's always about who's in charge. And ideally, it inserts it into a deeper communion. It strives to restore and bring one back to an original sense of self-gift rather than power, possession, the kind of things that I think so many of the students are struggling with. And there's no communion and no body-to-body sort of intimacy, like true embodied intimacy. And so they don't actually get a chance to have this sort of very serious reflection on the way that love, like when you fall in love with someone, you are very, very tempted to control them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, sex then becomes just part of this control without any awareness of how you learn to do this. I always tell them, you know, one of the gifts of being in a long-term relationship with someone is they can call you out very early on in the relationship, and that they can sort of say to you, like, you know, this is control. This is power. And so, you know, that root of power, control, violence, I think we have to recognize is at the root of all relationships. We can't be naive and just say, well, you can have ambiguous sex, and don't worry, everything is going to be cool. There's always sort of power and violence involved.
You know, that reminds, sorry to interrupt, but that reminds you, Joseph Pieper has a very short book called Abusive Language, Abusive Power. And he makes the point that marshalling language for something beside its purpose, right, which is sort of communion itself, is always to, in many ways, undo the very fabric of how God made man as a rational animal. This goes back to Dante says the worst sins are fraud and not, you know, incontinence. But what it seems to me, right, is we're to the point where we talk about which sins do we wish people could have, because some sins at least leave open a stronger possibility of repentance than others. So there's a book by Harry Frankfurt, it's called On BS, and I'm not going to go into it too much, but he makes the point that at least a liar has to know that they're lying, because to lie, you have to know you're saying a falsehood incorrectly. So there's always the chance the liar might come around. The problem with BS, right, is people eventually believe their own BS, and then you can't confront them with the truth. And it seems to me something similar is going on with what you're talking about in the book, Tim, is it's one thing to say humans have always maybe had difficulty with this, you know, sex and procreation stuff, but there's certainly a way in which, like, if you use relationships as power, but it's in person, that person always is staring you back. And the hope is, right, that eventually one of these people, that they'll have faces, like as C.S. Lewis says, and you have the chance to turn around. What I think happens now is we act like, well, if I do all this digitally, I'm not hurting anyone. But eventually, it seems that you'll get to the point of no return where you'll never have the chance to be confronted and have a true chance at repentance.
Yeah, it's a nice point. Yeah, I mean, there is really something about that. And that's where relationships end. People break up. They come to their own sort of determinations that, you know, that they don't need this. They walk away, and then there's this loss of communion. So, yeah, I think that's right. I mean, which sin is the worst sin? It's, you know, at least the one where someone can call you out.
But well, what's your worst sin, Bud? No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
My worst sin? No, actually, you know, I know we're pretty close to a break, and I'm kind of nervous to, like, I'm kind of prone to asking really broad, complex questions right before the break. But as I was flipping through the book again last night, you know, obviously when we talk about all these issues, one thing that comes up for Catholics is the question of contraception. And Tim, I was struck by your point that, like, in some ways, to use contraception is to deny, like, the totality of your wife as a person, you know, because she's a person who can have children. And I guess I was gonna ask nitty gritty, like, when you talk to those who are involved in marriage formation, like, do you give them any sort of input on, like, when and how do we bring up contraception?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways I don't, but one of the things, or I haven't sort of explicitly addressed that, but it's based in the very pedagogy of my class, which is I refuse to speak about contraception, sort of the sexual issues that I think are the really attractive ones for undergraduates to talk about, until we have a framework by which we could actually talk about them. So until they understand what marriage is, we can't talk about contraception. Otherwise, they really just think that the church is making up a series of rules for no reason. Yeah. And so until we have a philosophical, theological foundation, we don't address ethical issues. I'm in some ways the anti-ethicist.
No, I think that's important for people to hear you say that, is if we start playing the sort of game, the world's game on their terms, it's always just going to be like, here's an array of options, here's one of many, and these other ones sound more fun or more safe, et cetera, et cetera. The hard work is to try to set out why that's wouldn't you say that it's like that's even just the wrong way to even ask the question?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly, I think, you know, people come in, my undergraduates, everyone I know comes in presuming that contraception is just what one uses. It's not their fault in the sense, like, they didn't say, like, well, the church's teaching is stupid and I really like this one myself. It was just informed that this was the normative way because for many of them, sex is the very center of marriage. And so they couldn't imagine not engaging in sex. So unless they understand that the center of marriage is actually this sort of self-gift, this embodied self-gift through the entirety of one's life, then only then can you sort of say, like, well, there could be times in your life where you wouldn't have sex and that you would actually, I don't know, try to have children because the gift of this sort of love is to be instantiated and incarnate in a particular person. So until you get to the point where you can have that conversation, you're basically just fighting, you're fighting everything. Mm. And you're fighting everything, and they may even feel guilty about it, so you're also fighting against their guilt, and so they're shutting you down. And so you have to sort of provide a horizon. I mean, to me, this is the best of what Pope Francis means, I think in some sense, when he talks the way he does, which is you got to begin with a kerygma. You got to begin with something that moves the horizon, and only then can you say, all right, well, this is what it would mean to live this life.
Well, I think that's something that we're always getting out of the show is that before we even get into particular debates, the horizon has to change. And, we're getting ready to go to break. Stick around, and when we get back, we'll talk to more with Dr. Tim O'Malley precisely about these horizons and maybe practical ways to get people to shift their vision a bit. So stick around when we get back from these breaks. Like I said, Bo Bonner, Bud Maher, speaking with Dr. Tim O'Malley. We'll be back after these breaks. Back with the Uncommon Good, Bo Bonner and Dr. Bud Maher. Bud, take it away and tell everyone who our guest is today.
Yeah, we're back with Tim O'Malley, who's with the McGrath Institute for Church Life at the University of Notre Dame. He's published extensively, but his most recent book is Off the Hook, God, Love, Dating, and Marriage in a Hookup World. It's available through Ave Maria Press. Tim, thanks for being back with us.
Well, it's great to be here.
Yeah. So when Bo and I were studying together at Duke, during our ethics class, Stanley Hauerwas said to the class, like, I think one thing that took us aback, he said, like, you always marry the wrong person. And Hauerwas is kind of the king of hyperbole in the theology world. But I think he was getting at an important point there. And you sort of raised this topic in your book where you say, like, the idea of a soulmate can be actually, like, harmful or give us wrong impressions about what Christian marriage is all about. I think that's a good reminder because, like, a lot of times for myself, like, I can think of, like, well, the danger is coming from out there. But really, as communities of faith, sometimes we've imbibed, like, sort of misguided ideas about what it means to fall in love and to stay in love.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably the number one obstacle any of my undergraduates experience, that they really think, I mean, one of the reasons that they do hook up is because they have a vision that the only that marriage is going to be this sort of transcendent encounter with this soulmate who meets every one of your human needs. And so, you know, gosh, there's nothing you can do but wait with longing, a sort of expectation for this person to come along. And so, you know, they have almost impossible, unrealistic expectations about what concrete acts of, like, love and family life actually look like. And they really do imagine that they're just going to find the one and everything's going to be amazing and that there's no sort of formation that will happen when they encounter this person. You know, I was on a panel at World Youth Day celebrations a couple of weeks ago in D.C. at Catholic University, and they, you know, the panel was having a discussion, like, how did you know the person was the one? And, you know, I said, I knew Kara, my wife, was the one when I said the vows to her, because then she became the one. And in that sense, there wasn't, like, that God had planted a single human being in the world for me to find. That, you know, part of it is this risk of commitment, that this person who exists is the person I'm going to love forever. And I do love her, and I'm going to say that I will love her forever, and that will make her the one. And so it requires a different mindset, and I think we've picked up this sort of image of the soulmate less from the tradition of the church and more from romantic comedies and advertising that turns love into some sort of transcendent moment that bypasses everything and has no sort of particular embodied practices. That's why there's no kids on sitcoms.
Yeah. Well, and on that note, too, this is what confuses me is when people talk about the soulmates, you're like, man, you all had parents. Like, I love my mom and dad a lot, and I think they're great. They were, I never got the idea that they were like star-crossed lovers that were like, you know, these like perfect paradigms of the ideal form of love. Like, I remember them like arguing about who forgot to buy ingredients to cook burritos that night. You know, it's weird that people come up with that. And this goes to show you your idea about horizons and maybe the myopic way that we'll ignore things close at hand that actually give us like good indicators about how people might be, in steady relationships. And maybe it's because a lot of these kids, there's divorce or things like that. So they think they have to go look at, horrible Valentine's shows and whatnot. But it seems strange that all of the sort of local examples of good, you know, couples that stay together, none of them look like soulmates. And it's just crazy about how the power of bad narratives it can throw us off the trail, it seems to be.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah. And so, you know, part of me, when I teach, I try to sort of ground the students in just a recognition of what normal, mundane, married love looks like, and to sort of end that horizon, or end their sort of unrealistic expectation that when they fall in love with someone, they're just, you know, everything is just going to be magical. Not that it isn't great, but it's far more human, and actually that's what makes it great.
Tim, like one thing that I've seen throughout, like a thread through your books is obviously like the way that liturgy shapes our way of seeing the world. And I was just kind of curious, like in this book you draw on how the church's wedding liturgy or liturgy of marriage like really prepares us for the life ahead of us. Did you recognize that at the time? Was it profound for you, like, the day of, or has this been something that you've kind of been going back to and, like, returning to the liturgy and seeing the prayers there?
Yeah, my wife and I really gave a lot of attention to our wedding mass. I mean, it was more important to us than anything else. I remember, you know, we gave the priest very direct instructions about which prayers that he should use, which he was not used to. I think they were normally used to someone being like, do we have to use the Bible? And so, we had looked at the rite and made some determinations like this, we think, you know, sort of really embodies what we're talking about. For me, I would say I knew it abstractly that it was important, that it was defining. But one of the things that has been concrete for me is actually how attracted undergraduates are to studying a liturgical rite. Like you think a lot of the narratives about millennials or Gen iPhone or whatever we are in now, that they're not interested in like the practice of the church. That the only way you can talk to them about things is if you sort of sneak up on the other side and you talk about like ethics or sex or justice, and that they have no interest in things like sacraments or liturgy. What I've found is the opposite, is that they actually are super interested in the liturgy of marriage. What happens? What do you do? What does it mean? And, you know, again and again, what I've discovered is that when I go places to talk about the concrete liturgy of marriage, and more than just saying, like, here's what you do and here's why you do it, but to sort of understand it as a path of wisdom, lots of students come out for that because they want something. They recognize that there's something there. And, of course, doing this has made me realize how much the liturgy actually does matter to my own marriage.
Well, yeah, I was recently watching an episode of The Americans, this, you know, show about espionage and these Russian spies living in America.
Name drop, bud.
Yeah, sorry.
Name drop how cool you are. No, I'm kidding. Go ahead.
And again, it's a show that I don't know if I would necessarily recommend on air to all of our listeners, but it's a couple, you know, of Russian spies. They're living in the United States, and their lives do not conform in any way to, like, the faith or something like that. But they, at one point, they actually go to an Orthodox priest, and they do, like, they have their wedding vows confirmed. And it was really striking in the show. It kind of, like, for me, reinforced what you were just talking about, Tim, where, like at first they're almost like making light of it, like, oh, this is no big deal, but let's just do it, right? And then as the ceremony goes on, it's just like the symbolism and the language really, like, you can see the transformation on their faces. Sorry, Bo, I interrupted, but I think what Tim was just saying there is really, really true.
Well, I'm trying to think about what TV show I can say that would give me a lot of props and talk about marriage. Instead, I'm going to just be white trash. So, Tim, one thing that always drives me nuts is, so people decide they don't want to have marriage in a church. So, okay, fine. And I'm sure like half of the what you're talking about is like, why is it important to have in a church continuity and stuff? Why do people choose beaches? Like, beaches, like, who wants salt-smelling water blowing in your face and birds and, like, sand in your shoes? I want there to be, like, a really great takedown, Tim, about how you think weddings at a beach show everything that's, like, depraved about modern marriage, but I don't know if there is, and I really think I'm just complaining about beaches.
Well, I won't give a total and absolute takedown, but of its utter depravity, because technically it can be allowed in principle if the if your bishop allows it. So, there's actually a really interesting book by Eva Luz called "Consuming the Romantic Utopia."
Ooh.
And it's a study of how our practices and our images of love and dating have been shaped ultimately by consumer sort of, you know, high sort of consumer capitalism.
Right.
So, you know, it's a nice beach read itself. And but one of the things that this is very interesting is that if you look at early advertising around dating and marriage, it was grounded in very institutional structures. The goal was to get married, to have a family, and so you would have sort of pictures of families eating meals together, and it was literally, buy this Pyrex, it will allow you to cook food.
Right.
And one of the things that, you know, advertisers quickly discovered is that that only works for so long, because then eventually you're like, I have the Pyrex, I don't need anything else. And so you need increased desire. And so what began to happen was that there was a transformation of how advertisers sold things to people. Like, okay, so the goal is to have this sort of encounter, this transcendent encounter, you and your beloved. And children disappeared. And, you know, you would have the product and love next to each other. And this actually began to be related to vacations. And so if you look at, like, the Sandals resorts,
right.
It's always a couple without children engaging in perpetual romance, never getting burnt or, like, stepping on a crab or something like that.
Right.
Jellyfish.
Well,
yeah.
And so what happens is you have this kind of connection between love and transcendent romantic landscapes that are both, in essence, kind of cultural constructs given to us. And so people, when they say, like, well, I'm about to give my vows, I'm about to express, like, my total romantic love for this person, they think about the most romantic place that they can be. And it's not a church, but it's a beach.
Buffet. Oh. Beach, yes, my bad.
Well, buffet, I mean, it depends on where you grew up.
That's right.
The old country, Ryan's,
Yeah, no, so, okay, on this, what I think's crazy is you start looking at the history of romance, and so, you know, you get the courtly love tradition that starts to come in the Middle Ages. So I think sometimes, especially like young students are like, oh, we're going to go read the Romance of the Rose, or we're going to read this medieval stuff, and it will be basically a version of what we're getting to. And I'm like, guys, half the time with medieval romance, there's like actual no sexual consummation. That's part of the whole deal of romance. Romance is entirely different than like your wife, and it's wrapped up in warfare. So I bring that up to say, you know, it's funny how you can take something from a very different context and how consumerism can sort of try to domesticate it so you can make money off of it. Like, it's hard to make money off of, you know, the knightly ideal of chivalry. But it also, I think, is always important for people to realize that other eras, even when they started to really bask in the romantic and start to worry about their role in it, again, thinking of Dante and his worry about his, like, you know, love poems, that even back then, they seemed very aware about the sort of sheer danger of the power of this romantic erotic love, and that half of the conversation was about how do you keep it, you know, in check. And so it's funny that we in the modern world were like, hey, you know, this really, like, really wonderful but dangerous aspect of love, let's just tie that to marriage. There's probably no problems at all, right? Like, it's what could go wrong if we try to sell it to everybody?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and that's, you know, that's the essential. So, but it's really interesting. You can get students to really think about this and to understand how socially constructed some of their conceptions of love are and how wrong they are compared to what love actually is by, like, showing them commercials and actually asking them to reflect on it. It's one of the sort of greatest practices I think teachers today can perform is to really take these things head on and not just to say, like, okay, this is a wrong view, but to show them the sort of measures of by which the construction takes place.
Yeah, like, why are flowers romantic? You're like, here is the dead sex organ of a plant. I love you.
Yes, that's a
we're not sponsored by any floral shop.
Right, right. Yeah. Like, this is straight out.
No, Tim. when you swim out into the cultural waters, like when you move outside of conversations in the church, like a guideline for many people is the question of consent. And so, you know, sometimes I think in the church we might be nervous, like, oh, this word is used here. And it's inimical to what the church teaches. But you do have a section in your book about practicing consent and how, like, as Christians, as Catholics, we properly understand that. What do you say about consent near the end of the book?
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways the desire for consent socially right now reveals something true about love, that it really is a gift of self, that it's an active gift of the will. You know, I think the confusion with it is that it imagines that it's a sheer sort of rational event that one can make in the act of sexual activity itself, right? I mean, that you're engaging in a meeting with someone and you're engaged in sort of erotic activity, and then suddenly you're like, well, what about doing this thing? That's not the time for sort of rational analysis. But that real consent in the church, I mean, that is, in the Western tradition, is the heart of the sacrament, which is to really give yourself to this other person, to give yourself over to words that you didn't construct and you didn't create. And in that act of consent, it's really it is the natural bond of love that's established. It's a natural bond. It's a bond, though, that is transformed in that moment because it's taken up between the love of Christ and the church. And that turns every moment of existence into an act of consent. It becomes the couple's deepest identity no matter what they're doing. And so, you know, I think we can talk about consent, and because we actually have, as the head of our, as sort of the heart of our sacramental formula for marriage, we have consent, I think it provides an interesting, certainly inroad into conversation related consent. We shouldn't be afraid of having those conversations.
Yeah.
Well, I think interesting about that is, I mean, we're a show about the uncommon good. The way that marriage is usually spoken of in the past but has, like, sort of dropped off the radar is there's also a matter of social consent, right? The community consents to this, right? This is why there's witnesses. This is why, you know, even something like that we don't have anymore, like the bonds of marriage, and, you know, you put them in the newspaper to make sure that Jim is not actually Harold and has been married in, like, three counties, like in Nevada or whatever. There's this idea, right, that there's a social aspect to the consent. We consent for this marriage. And of course, that can be abused. You can think of all the monstrous ways that society can interfere with something like this. But I think that's sometimes completely. So it's not only the sort of romantic ideal that no one can ever live up to and silly ideas about soulmates, but to make it like this intensely atomized individual choice between two people. I mean, like, I think sometimes, you know, a lot of sermons are pretty good about, like, well, it's not just a marriage of two people, it's a marriage of two families. But it's also really society stitching itself together. And that's why we can't give up on these discussions, for instance, in the larger culture, because every marriage is social and part of the common good.
Yeah, that's what that's how my course ends, is we talk about family and the life sort of what marriage establishes. And, you know, I just underline to them that this is not just your personal experiment. You know, I always say to them, why do you think the state gives you a tax, because they a sort of tax benefit, because they thought how amazing your love was? And
you're like, oh, wow, Bud and Rachel, wow, it's intense.
No, that's intense. Here's, you know, 3% off your sort of yearly income tax. Like, they do it because there's a social benefit to marriage, because it's how society is passed on. It's how children are born. It's how children are raised. And that, you know, we have a sense of the nuclear family that's driven by the same romantic sort of commercial view of family life, that the family is not this sort of insular island, but that actually the family has a responsibility to engage and to renew society by being very concrete. I mean, we make a contrast in my class between an open family and a closed family. And a closed family is like a suburban wonderland. You hire everyone to do everything in your house. You're closed off. Whereas an open family really says, like, okay, we live here and we're engaged in social relationships with our neighbors. And if we're not engaged with those relationships with our neighbors, then we actually haven't made this sort of sacrament, this love that sort of emerges forth, really concrete and incarnate in the world, which is really the vocation of the married couple.
Well, Tim, this has been great, and we're really grateful for your time. I would certainly encourage anyone listening to go find Tim's book, Off the Hook. Give it to a college student or someone involved in faith formation. But Tim, if our listeners want to learn more about like the kind of work that you're involved in, are there other places they can go to find more?
Yeah, you can go to easiest places, mcgrath.nd.edu. That's our institute, and it will reveal things that we do in liturgy, catechesis, sacramental formation. We'll have our journal and our blog and everything on there. So it's a great place to go.
I think people should stalk you on Twitter. You always do a good job of bringing up really interesting stuff. And if they want to hear what it's like to see a Notre Dame fan get disappointed at a bar or in a hotel they're staying at, like, you're the go-to account, really, Tim.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I'm very good at disappointment. practicing it for years.
I do have to apologize on air. I kind of jumped on Notre Dame after their loss to Clemson, but as the national championship game showed, Clemson was very good this season.
Yeah, I mean, Notre Dame was never going to beat Clemson. That was a very obvious thing to anyone with a brain. But it was nice to see Alabama reduced to tears.
That's right. That was so delicious.
That was sort of a really early Valentine's gift for nearly
everyone. Oh, absolutely. And better than Valentine's Day, really, for me.
Well, Bo, I'm scheming to bring Tim to Pittsburgh, and I think you got to do the same in Des Moines.
Yeah, well, we'll get Tim on the next world tour that he's doing. He can come by and stop by Des Moines and Pittsburgh. And you need to make a T-shirt, Tim, all the cities you've been to.
Yes. Such exotic locales as Alexandria, Louisiana, and other places like that.
Yeah, that's right.
But Bud, you're going to do the big thing for Newman? Like, are you guys going to do like the big Newman celebration for the canonization?
Yeah, well, we're bringing in Ben King this fall from Sewanee, and I think he's going to do a great job talking about the canonization. I was checking flights this morning. I really hope to be there myself.
Are they going to do it in Birmingham?
I'm guessing it's going to be Rome. I heard that last time when Pope Benedict came to England for the beatification, that it was complicated and expensive. So I think even the Birmingham Oratorians are hoping that it's in Rome this go-around.
Man, the British can't even pull off.
Yeah. Well, they did a good job.
Yeah, I'm sure that the problem is they did too good of a job because they were British and they believed in things that were complicated that Italians don't worry about.
That's right. In Rome, they're all like, they'll fit. Yeah, we'll get them all in there. All right, so Tim, thanks for coming on the show.
No problem.
Yeah, take care, man.
Thanks, Tim.
Yeah,
good to talk to you.
Yeah. Well, but this is the Uncommon Good. May Jesus Christ, the Prince of Peace, reign in our families, in our city, our state, our nation, the world, the galaxy, the whole shebang. This is the Uncommon Good. We'll be back next Wednesday.
The Uncommon Good with Bo Bonner and Dr. Bud Maher is heard every week on wonderful Catholic stations like this one and anytime on podcast. Just search for The Uncommon Good.